Welcome to This Old Tree, a show that features heritage trees and their human stories. You'll hear interviews with experts, historians, and regular folks to celebrate the myths and uncover the real tales. This Old Tree is sponsored by Schwartz Tree and Landscaping in Cranston, Rhode Island. Professional tree service, landscaping, and plant management. Visit SchwartzTreeCare.com or call 401-941-4440. This show is also sponsored by Foods of New York Tours. Hungry? There's nothing like heading to New York City for some of the best cuisine in the world. Book through their website at foodsofny.com or call 332-236-9635. Now, here is your host, Doug Still.
The place is Concord, Massachusetts, the year 1856. At 10 a.m. on a January day, four men began removing a huge American elm tree trunk using block and tackle and ropes drawn by a horse. The upper branches had been removed a few days before. Prior to this, the tree along the main road was seemingly healthy and was a village marker seen by everyone passing through the old colonial town. The tree towered above a house owned by Mr. and Mrs. Charles B. Davis, but they heard some creaking in a storm that winter and said one of the branches was cracked. They were fearful and wanted it down. The event would have been long forgotten, except one of America's greatest writers and earliest environmentalists also lived in Concord, Henry David Thoreau. The removal of the stately elm set him off, at least in a flurry of journal writing. Today's episode is about why the tree was such a touchstone for him, and more broadly, why the American elm was so important to the character of New England towns in the 19th century, and ultimately streetscapes across the country to the present day. I have a wide-ranging discussion about it with my guest, Thomas Campanella, professor and historian at Cornell University, who wrote the fascinating book, Republic of Shade, New England and the American Elm. Turns out, elm trees help define our young nation's sense of itself. Real or constructed, you can decide for yourself. Thanks for joining me today. I'm your host, Doug Still, and welcome to This Old Tree.
This old tree, standing here for more than four centuries. Wonder what you'd say if you could talk to me.
If you're listening to this podcast, you're a tree lover. So speaking for most of us, we've all felt those feelings of loss that Thoreau felt that day in January 1856. Perhaps you once heard the buzzing of chainsaws near your home to find out that a neighbor has taken down a mature oak tree, say. Or maybe a developer cleared all the trees from an entire lot in order to build a house and couldn't bother to save even the biggest. Or in the name of progress, a road project bludgeoned its way through the roots of a grand old street tree, leading to its demise with the explanation that it couldn't be saved. Maybe some of the reasons were good, maybe not, but there was no mistaking that feeling in your gut of irrevocable loss of both an honorable life and the repository of fond memories. Believe me, as city forester, I've experienced firsthand the raw emotions of residents spurred by the removal of trees, young and old. Thoreau had published Walden just a few years before, the work for which he is best known. It is a memoir of living alone on nearby Walden Pond for 2 years, a celebration of nature and simple living. It had precise measurement and observation of his natural surroundings, and described a great appreciation for the rhythms of life we take for granted. A transcendentalist, Thoreau wove a spiritual dimension throughout the book, with reflections on solitude and meditation. But Thoreau's writing also offered some bite toward materialistic contemporary culture and the foolishness of some of his peers, especially politicians. The removal of the Concord elm tree brought out his cranky side, brilliant and intellectual, but cranky nonetheless. After describing the takedown in great detail and taking measurements of the old friend, he said that if the town clerk won't chronicle the tree's fall, then he would. For it is of greater moment to the town than that of many a human inhabitant would be. Instead of erecting a monument to it, we take all possible pains to obliterate its stump, the only monument of a tree which is commonly allowed to stand. He claims to have eulogized the tree, but it seems to me that a sort of pissed-off sourness was just below the surface. He wrote, "I've attended the felling and, so to speak, the funeral of this old citizen of the town. I, who commonly do not attend funerals, as it became me to do so. I was the chief, if not the only mourner there. I have taken the measure of his grandeur, have spoken a few words of eulogy at his grave, but there were only the choppers and the passers-by to hear me. Further, the town was not represented. The fathers of the town, the selectmen, the clergy were not there. But I have not known a fitter occasion for a sermon of late. Since its kindred could not attend, I attended. I'm paraphrasing different parts, but he goes on that, "Methinks its fall marks an epoch in the history of the town. It has passed away together with the clergy of the old school and the stagecoach which used to rattle beneath it. Its virtue was that it steadily grew and expanded from year to year to the very last. How much of old Concord falls with it? Another link that bound us to the past has been broken." I had the privilege of talking about all this with Tom Campanella. Because this old tree in Concord was an American elm, I learned that its loss was charged with symbolism that reached into our national identity. Thomas Campanella is professor of history and regional planning at Cornell University, and he has written extensively about the history of American urbanism and landscape, especially in New York City and in particular Brooklyn. He's also written about urbanism and city planning in China and the rapid growth happening there. But what brings Tom to us today is his work on the cultural importance of the American elm in American history, especially in New England. He wrote a book in 2003 called Republic of Shade, New England and the American Elm, which won the Spiro Kostoff Award from the Society of Architectural Historians. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to have you here today. I loved your book on the American Elm. And it's a great read for anyone who loves trees and history, which such as myself. And I learned a lot about why this tree holds such an esteemed place within the greater pantheon of trees. And yeah, also because it helped define an image of the quintessential American town or streetscape.
Yes, exactly.
In real terms, but also within our memory and psyche. So we're going to come back to that in a minute.
Yeah. Sure.
But I'd love to start by talking about one story in particular that you wrote about an American elm in Concord, Massachusetts. And the year is 1856. And this was a huge, gorgeous elm tree that stood over the house of Charles B. Davis, who ran the post office and was a storekeeper, apparently.
Yeah.
And it was known by everyone, especially the great American nature writer, Henry David Thoreau. And he wrote about this tree. And I would love to ask you if you wouldn't mind describing what happened and why he wrote about this tree.
Well, first of all, it's a testament to Thoreau's wonderful capacity to appreciate even the quotidian, you know, and the everyday. Aside from trees, which are, I always have felt that they tend to be very invisible to most people. It's remarkable to me how, you know, we pay attention to almost every detail and minutia about the built environment. And yet somehow trees have long evaded our attention. And so to come across a Thoreau who vests so much meaning and significance, you know, in trees, is just such a joy. And this tree in particular, to be honest, it is not a tree like the Wethersfield elm, which was, you know, maybe 12 feet in diameter. It's a relatively young American elm by his measure, quite literally. It was 125, 127 years old. And of course, he is an inveterate tree ring counter. He counts tree rings the way he plumbed the depths of Walden Pond. And, you know, and he writes about how, you know, ignorance is so sticky and persistent in that, you know, people would, you know, many townspeople in Concord continued to believe that Walden Pond had no, you know, had no bottom, that it was limitless in depth, and or was, you know, many fathoms deep. And all he did was go out in a rowboat and plumb the depths, and he came up with a number to prove that they were all being superstitious and ignorant. And the same thing about this elm, which some people thought was 200 years old and others thought it was only 50 years old or something like that.
He was like, just count the rings.
He counts the rings, right? And he comes up with a number. And 127 years is not really that old for a tree like an American elm, right? The some of the great New England elms that I came across in the research for Republic of Shade were much older than that, twice, you know, maybe even three times that age. And there are still not many, but there are still some elms in New England that can claim to be a couple of hundred years old. There was one on the outskirts of Hartford, within a site of the airport there. I forget the name of the airfield. That must have been about 200, 250 years old. I don't know if it's still there. But anyway, this tree, this elm that Thoreau talks about is it's not that. I think he says it's 15 feet in circumference, which is only maybe a 4 foot diameter breast height tree, right? It's big, but it's not a monster. It's certainly not one of the great, really big elms in New England at that time. And yet he mourns it, and appropriately so.
So this tree came down.
Yes, it's cut down because, and this is something, you know, that I've encountered myself so many times, regrettably, you know, it was a threat, you know, it's, you know, some creaking, yeah, some creaking sounds, ominous sounds were heard, you know, which are, I think, quite dubious. But anyway, I take it was the homeowner who was afraid that it might come down on the
it
house.
Like he thought it was a little dubious as well, the way
it probably was. I mean, trees creak. I mean, they make noises. They're living entities. When the wind blows through, you know, a tree, it obviously creaks. You know, I think Emerson wrote about the hoarse concert, quote unquote, that tree limbs, you know, brushing against the roof would make in the wind. But anyway, the tree comes down.
And so it's in full leaf. Yeah. I mean, it looks healthy, and there's a creek.
And it probably was a perfectly healthy tree. It's just that when someone, you know, I've had people say this to me, they, you know, the tree, you know, is near their house, and even if it fell, it wouldn't even reach the house. And yet it's even on campus, at Cornell, we used to have heritage trees, and, you know, in the UK, there's a whole program about protecting heritage trees. We seem to have hazard trees now. Some of the oldest trees on the Cornell campus, you know, 200, 250 year old oaks have come down in recent years, perfectly healthy trees.
We're a litigious society, and there's also a fear of large trees.
Yeah, the risk management people. I always joke the risk management office at Cornell is like the basically runs the university. I can say this because I'm tenured, by the way. And so anyway, you know, if a tree is deemed a hazard, then all the other values go out the window, even if it is perfectly healthy and poses really no hazard at all. So this tree comes down lamentably. And it seems that Thoreau is perhaps the only person who appreciates and mourns the passing of this tree. So it I think more than just that tree, right? It becomes a symbol and a touchstone for Thoreau, representing the elm generally, and I think trees and nature generally.
So he eulogized the tree, or at least he said he did.
Yeah, that's right.
But he said there's no one here to hear this eulogy. There are no town selectmen. And there was another tree in Massachusetts, the Deerfield elm, or the literary elm that you wrote about, that was removed in 1853, so 3 years earlier. And it was in the press, and they had a memorial service and town dignitaries in town. So I'm wondering if he was referencing that in a way, like in Deerfield, they had this big memorial service, and here there's nobody here.
Yeah, no, that was a monster, that elm. I there's a photo in my book of a local antiquarium sort of mourning standing there, and he's quite elderly with a long white beard. So there's a certain symmetry between man and tree. But also remember, Deerfield had a different presence in the cultural memory of New England at that time. Now we look back at Concord as having this enormous historical significance because of people like Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and others, Nathaniel Hawthorne. But I think they looked to Deerfield as in an equivalent dimension that we look perhaps to Concord today. So I think that's why that tree got more press and more coverage. It was a storied tree. I can't remember the details, but it was a witness to the clashes with Native Americans that occurred in Deerfield, many, many decades or a century earlier.
So what did Thoreau feel was lost when this tree came down?
Well, I think aside from the magnificence of it as a natural being, right, as a representative of the natural world, I think he felt it was a witness. And, these witness trees were, a real presence in the Yankee landscape in the 19th century, because they were said to have been there and witnessed these historical moments, right? Some of them were the subject of enormous exaggeration and inaccuracy. The Washington Elm in Cambridge is the best example of that. But I think that's part of it, right? He mourned the fact that no one seemed to appreciate that this was a tree that was present in the birth, at the moment of the birth of this town, or at least its nascence, its early years, right? 127 years, it doesn't really go back to the actual founding, but close, right?
And you write of that he or people at that time felt that elms in a way consecrated the landscape.
Right.
So compared to, the white spires of the churches, that they linked earth and heaven. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's actually a concept that Mircea Eliade writes about or wrote about, this notion of an axis mundi, right? Latin for basically a pivot of the world that links the sacred and the profane, right? And yeah, the church steeple, the meeting house steeple is, a very classic example. And we have that verticality in many, many cultures. You look at some of the temples in classical Indian architecture, is also that vertical, that point of connectivity between the realms, the heavens and the earth. Yeah, there's a certain symmetry that emerges between the temple, the meeting house steeple, the church steeple in New England, and the towering solitary elm, right? In many towns, there was a single elm, often from the settlement period or reputedly from the settlement period, that was a totem, right? It had a totemic role in one of the best examples is the Pittsfield Elm, which was this enormous tree of great height and girth. And it was reputed to have been a remnant of the original forest or the aboriginal forest, as was often said. So it had a witness role, but also this totemic role. And things, community events would take place or be held at the base of the tree, right? Mm. And over time, these totemic trees, aside from being witnesses to many, maybe a century's worth of history or more, tended to draw significant events to them, even events that had, that took place quite a ways away. They suddenly, or over time, I should say, they became associated with this, totemic entity in the landscape.
When you think of early drawings or etchings of a New England town, and they're picking an image to choose to represent that town, it's usually the meeting house or the church, and then an elm.
Yeah,
I think, and that sort of became this image that we remember. And the spire is pointy, and the elm is sort of the opposite. It's like like a fountain.
It's a fountain. It's, you know, that was one of the reasons why this tree was so embraced early on. It has this remarkably beautiful form, and it is like a fountain spray, right? It's often described as a wine glass. I think of it more as a fountain spray, and it's remarkably beautiful. And the limb structure too, even in the winter when the leaves are gone, it has this Medusan sort of tangle of limbs that is just so beautifully sculptural. And when you put them next to each other, as you know, in a line, a street or a commons that are lined with, it creates a remarkable image of a Gothic arch, which, remember, yeah, this is in the middle years of the 19th century. This had itself a lot of significance because a lot of these architectural revivals were, Gothic architecture is very popular in that period, including the Gothic revival. And often you have these streets referred to in those terms, that they were, you know, rough-hewn or unhewn cathedrals, right? And this was a nation that had turned its profane streets into cathedrals.
That's something I always used to say in describing, you know, what the streets used to look like when they were lined with American elms in their cities and towns, this cathedral like canopy. And I guess I just heard that from somewhere, and I would sort of repeat it, but it creates an image. It's just interesting to hear that there's this sort of other source or meaning to it from the 19th century. It's all connected.
Yeah. And there was actually at least one attempt to create a cathedral with elm. It was Montgomery Miggs' father. Montgomery Miggs was an architect who became very prominent in the Civil War and post-Civil War era. He designed the old Pension Building in Washington, which is where the National Building Museum is. But yeah, there's that imagery, and it's a really remarkable. You know, you and I are too young to remember the elms as a major presence in American towns and cities.
Right.
But I often tell people, you know, who say, well, I really wish I could experience what Elm Street was like. And of all places, I would say the best example, the best place to go to experience that is the Central Park Mall in New York City. The mall there, those elms are really reaching a glorious date of elder age, and it is really the closest thing I know of. I mean, Washington Mall in Washington also, but those trees tend to be a bit smaller.
And they lead up to Bethesda Fountain.
Sure.
And you sort of get a taste of the 19th century, I feel, in that.
Oh, yeah,
that
very
landscape.
Much so. It's a Victorian, middle 19th century to Victorian era landscape.
At that time, the forests of New England were denuded. I mean, they were cleared.
Yeah.
There's hardly any old growth forests left.
Right.
Our forests now are about 140 years old when they stopped doing the cutting. Right. So in the 1850s, Thoreau's responding to, why are we clearing all in the forests? You know, and I think trees became a little bit more valuable to him too for that reason.
Right.
And I can see why they would gather under the trees too, just for some shade and as a focal point.
So the interesting thing that, and this is something that I uncovered and came across again and again in the early literature of New England, and especially I use the, you know, old agricultural journals and newsletters to do some of the deep research for this book. But the elm was often, first of all, the elm does not grow in pure stands like some trees do, right? It is not a tree that you see many of or a pure stand of in the forest. It's a solitary tree, much like the American sycamore. You know, you'll have one there and another one some hundred yards away. And it's also a bottomland and lowland tree, right? It's not an upland tree. So what happened is the elms were saved, ironically, by their enormous size in many cases, or at least the older ones were, because it would take an enormous amount of effort to cut one of these down. Also, as far as clearing the fields, you know, why do you clear the fields? You want ground to plant, but you also want to free the ground from shade. Well, these older elms, in addition to being in many days' labor to cut down, they had a form that lifted the crown right so high up that it if you imagine the sun going through its diurnal path, it would move that shadow, the crown shadow, very rapidly through the field. So it wasn't as much of a problem as you would have, say, with a dense oak or maple tree that created an almost permanent pool of shade around its base. So
the wood wasn't as valuable either.
And that's the other thing. The wood was not very valuable. So, you know, when you cut a maple or an oak, you could get a return on it because the wood was sought after. Elm wood is very stringy. It's hard to cut. It's got, you know, there are certain uses that it's appropriate for. But what I'm getting to here is these solitary elms were often left behind. And so they gain a presence in the New England imagination, right? They are there. They're magnificent. They're beautiful. They have this form. And that is the seed stock for the later mass planting of this tree. Once we get to the period of that we refer to as the village improvement era, the village improvement societies organize. And one of the main things they do, one of the first things they do is plant trees on the commons, on the streets in their towns to beautify them. And there's a whole set of reasons why they were doing that, but they look to the American elm as their number one tree.
I thought it was fascinating when you wrote about sort of prior to that movement, that the nation was essentially, you know, had some insecurities or an inferiority complex with Europe, and we were a young nation. And so the fashion was to plant exotics.
Yeah, right.
And there was one in particular that got planted a lot, the Lombardy poplar.
Yeah, Lombardy poplar, that's right.
And so the Lombardy poplar is this very columnar upright tree,
right,
pointy. It's one associates it with northern Italy or central Italy, Tuscany,
right,
and sort of archaic landscapes, ruins, Italian towns, and very strong on the eye.
Yeah,
I don't know how you would describe it.
They would plant. Yeah, the Lombardy poplar was a very popular tree in the first few decades of the 19th century. There are images and etchings and drawings of, for example, Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, lined, you know, from the White House up to the Capitol, lined with Lombardies. There are countless images of towns and cities in the Northeast. And you see, as you said, it's such a distinctive tree. Even an amateur painter or artist could get them right. In Boston, streets were lined with these.
And very uniform.
Yeah, very uniform. And there were two main reasons why it became so popular. First of all was the imagery and the associations, right? They were associated with the storied lands of antiquity, right? And this is an era when a lot of artists are going and studying and painting these classical landscapes, right? And so there's a certain attraction there. The other reason, quite frankly, and this is also why the American elm is so embraced, is an extremely fast-growing tree, right? So if you have a place that is as upstart and as unkempt and as kind of daggy as American towns were and cities were at this time, you want something that's going to bring a modicum of beauty quickly, right? You don't want to plant, a white oak and have to wait, a century for it to create some. And Lombardy poplar, Jesus, it must grow a foot a day in this early summer. It doesn't last very long. That's the drawback. But there's a law, and I, what happens here is these exotics, and it wasn't just the Lombardy. Lombardy was a very popular one, but another one was Ailanthus altissima, the tree of heaven, which is also a very rapid growing tree. It is now on, countless lists of invasive species, but it's a very tenacious tree. It had its defenders even after the Greek backlash against exotics. And it still has its defenders. I am very fond of the Tree of Heaven, although some will call it the Tree of Hell.
So it was brought from China.
Yes.
And it was valued for its foliage and fast growing. And I actually have some close friends who live in a house built in 1790 here in Providence.
Ew.
And they have an enormous, enormous ailanthus.
Wow.
That frames the house, and it's spectacular. And
that
it, reading this makes me wonder how old that tree is, and if it dates that far back or not.
It's hard to tell. I know of some enormous ailanthus trees in Brooklyn, actually. And, it's a tree that was originally brought here to, as part of an ill-fated effort to develop a native, an American silk industry.
Right.
Because the
along with mulberry too
and mulberry right and you know the what happened was the cynthia moth the moth that feed the larvae feed on ailanthus didn't do very well in the climate although they are around. When I was a teenager, the very first essay I ever published was about collecting the tiny baby larvae, immature larvae, in an ailanthus grove along the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn and raising these moths. But the tree certainly has taken off.
So I just want to read one passage from your book that made me laugh out loud just because it was so interesting and sort of funny. And this back to the Lombardy poplar. Mm. The use of the Lombardy poplar in America may have had an even more distinguished pedigree. Samuel Eliot Morison claimed that the tree had been introduced by none other than the classicist Thomas Jefferson. In the early decades of the 19th century, he wrote, it was a sign of unterrified democracy in New England to plant Lombardy poplars, the dendrological badge of Jeffersonian republicanism. Of course, the Federalists turned the badge against its benefactor, pointing out that the Lombardy's soft, pulpy wood and attraction for worms resembled the brain of the gentleman who introduced them.
That's funny, yeah.
So it becomes this sort of propaganda.
No, that's a wonderful passage. And I had forgotten about that. You know, what happens, though, with these trees is as the young American nation reaches adolescence and begins to, you know, find itself and flex its muscles and becomes more confident in itself and its culture, there's a huge backlash against these so-called exotics. And it can get pretty vehement and even racist at times.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, particularly about the ailanthus.
Right.
Could you describe?
Well, the ailanthus, as anyone who's struggled to with it in their garden will know or will recognize it. It rapidly spreads by root. It sends out roots and it sprouts from the roots. There's a term.
And this is the tree along train tracks and empty lots. Yeah. And it's a tree grows in Brooklyn.
It tree grows in Brooklyn. Exactly. It's a very tenacious tree. It spreads very rapidly, both by seed, but also by its root system. And so once it gets established, it's pretty hard to fight back. It's reminiscent of the more recent arrival here from Asia, the Japanese knotweed, which, boy, you get that going. You really need a backhoe to excavate it out. So what happens here is there's as Americans discover as they gain confidence, they start looking to the native trees, right? The trees of the American forest and saying, why don't we plant these trees? There's a very strong nativist element.
Nationalism.
Native plant movement. It's a very nationalistic, nativist, and even racist embrace of American trees, right? We don't want the foreigner. And what happens is that the ailanthus in particular gets painted in very racist terms, that it's this, you know, I think the early and pioneering horticulturist and landscape designer, Andrew Jackson Downing, is infamous for this because he refers to the ailanthus as I think he describes it as a wily Asiatic, right, whose intermeddling roots are threatening our American democracy or our American republic. I'm paraphrasing a little, and he quite vociferously advocates its you know purging of this tree, right? And so this maps to political movements at the time to ban immigration from China and from elsewhere in Asia. And this is when you really have the wholesale embrace of American tree species, including and primarily the American elm, at least in the northeastern part of the New England.
So in the 1830s and 1840s, this sort of movement to plant native trees, especially elm, takes off.
Yeah.
There's this tree bee in Sheffield, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
What's the tree bee?
Well, you know, what's going on in rural New England at this time is a really difficult passage, actually, for the residents and the these communities. These were very successful farming communities. They were quite affluent in many cases. And all of a sudden, the rural agricultural economy goes into a very steep decline. And these, the local leadership, the elected officials, the elders of these towns are struggling to both keep the young people from leaving, but also they recognize over time, and this is more in the second half of the 19th century, that affluent, successful folks who grew up in these towns, grew up in rural New England, and then went and found their fortunes in the Hartfords and the Bostons and the Springfields and the New York Cities, they want to come back to their roots. And there's the beginnings of summer vacationing and tourism in these places. So if you combine these, the feeling was we had better make these very beautiful, picturesque, attractive places. And, you know, when you stir into this mix, the iconography of Currier Knives, for example, you know, the elm tossed, you know, New England green or common with its church and meeting house steeple, that becomes something people expect, right? That's what they're looking for and that's what they want. And many, many New England towns didn't have that. There were plenty of towns where the common was just a scruffy field, right? It had no elm. And so what happens is there's a movement throughout. It starts in the Berkshires and in Western Massachusetts and Connecticut, and it spreads throughout New England. And it's a beautification movement. It's usually referred to as the village improvement movement. And there were these village improvement societies founded, and that spreads to New York too. I should say that the reason for the sudden decline in the agricultural economy, the rural economy of New England, had everything to do with a piece of major infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, that is developed in New York, and that's the Erie Canal. What the Erie Canal did, much like, you know, you can imagine it as a major interstate, for example, and in fact, the New York State Thruway follows 100 years later or more the exact route of the Erie Canal. The Erie Canal put New York City and the Port of New York in very close and easy touch to some of the enormously productive, enormously fertile farmland in upstate New York, right? And so it what happens is New England agriculture is kind of cut out of the loop. Farming in New England was never easy, right? You've got a very, you know, very dramatic climate, very cold, long winters. The soils are very stony. So here now is this very, you know, productive farmland that's within easy reach of the greatest port on the eastern seaboard. So that is the reason why these towns go into decline. So the village improvers, the first and most significant thing they do, project they undertake, is the planting of these elm trees, and that is what leads to the tree bee The Treby was the earliest example that I've come across of a mass planting effort, right? So everybody in the town of Sheffield gets together and they plant dozens, if not, you know, scores.
Thousands of trees, yeah.
Yeah, hundreds of elm saplings and whips. And over time, Sheffield becomes renowned for its beautiful, you know, elm-lined streets and commons.
There was an intellectual meeting place in Western Mass that involved the Sketch Club. Mm-hmm. I heard about the Sketch Club. And that is William Cullen Bryant. Who's in the Sketch Club?
The Sketch Club, as I recall it, was a group of, you know, was a literary group and artists who, and I talk about it because there was a certain connection there between this village improvement movement and the embrace of the elm in Western Massachusetts and the Berkshires and the literary scene in New York City. So there's a connection there to the larger emerging society or culture of the United States and New York.
And it's artists too, right? The Hudson School and
exactly.
Emerson.
There's this, I describe it as the environmental awakening. There's this movement that, you know, that emerges in this period. And the village improvement movement is a good example of one of its expressions, right? There's this sense that prior to the environmental awakening, nature was a resource to be exploited, right? And it's the environmental awakening that it's very much rooted in romanticism coming, you know, from France and elsewhere in the old world. But it's a whole new attitude to the about the natural world, and one that is much more about respecting and admiring and nurturing the values therein, instead of just an exploitative stance. And this is, you know, the transcendentalists come out of this larger milieu. The Hudson River School of painters, of landscape painting, comes out of this milieu. And in a more quotidian, prosaic way, you've got the village improvers. Andrew Jackson Downing is also part of this. He's writing about, mm-hmm. you know, the improvement of one's home grounds, right? And this whole, this new yearning for spatial beauty, as I think John Stilgo, at the landscape historian at Harvard, put it.
So back to Thoreau, he came just after this, or was he part of?
Well, he's part of the. Code? He's a core member, you know, part of the transcendentalist movement. That's right. I don't think he was a Sketch Club,
and but he definitely influenced by them and knew Emerson, obviously.
Yeah, and William Cullen Bryant is a major part of this whole, you know, embrace of nature and the natural world. There's also a nationalistic dimension here because, you know, and Downing writes about this too. You know, there's this sense, you know, you mentioned earlier that Americans in the early Republic and the early 19th century had this cultural inferiority complex where anything of any value, right, artistic, literary, had to come from the old world, right? Anything created, written, thought of here really didn't have much, you know, gravitas because it was an upstart nation. That starts changing. It starts changing in the Jacksonian period. And by the time you get to, you know, the middle years of the 19th century, it's not just expressed in an embrace of native trees, but a stance that looks to the natural world, right, and the extraordinary heritage of North America, the natural heritage, Niagara Falls, the Grand Canyon, the Shenandoahs, the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Adirondacks. Americans start looking to that as the equivalent, right, and more of the cultural achievements of the old world. So the old world has its Parthenon, its Pantheon, its, you know, its extraordinary architectural heritage and the ruins in, you know, of the Roman era and the medieval landscapes of Northern Europe. And Americans say, well, that's great. You have all that, but we have these extraordinary places, these extraordinary natural monuments that are from directly from the hand of the creator. So they're saying, we're one-upping you because this is nature's nation. This is a place uniquely blessed by God.
And Thoreau's responding to that when we cut down all our forests, we're right. sort of abusing that notion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So it's the 1850s and the Civil War is about to happen and the abolitionist movement is tearing the country apart, essentially. And he uses elm trees. I don't know if specifically the elm tree that we're talking about as a metaphor for the abolitionist movement and the Free Soil Party. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. The details of this will escape me, but he uses the elm as a symbol of the, this is a period when there's this, the Free Soilers and there's this struggle over whether, not only the Fugitive Slave Act, which basically criminalized anyone who was assisted a slave escaping the South, but there was a fight over whether slavery should be extended west, right?
And that's and the Free Soil Party is in response to that.
Exactly right. He's very facile in adapting the metaphor of the American elm and these trees to various political issues of the day.
Could I read you a passage from your book, or read our, for our listeners? That is,
yeah, please.
The elms, right, Thoreau, are free soilers in their own broad sense. They send their roots north and south and east and west into many a conservative's Kansas and Carolina, who does not suspect such underground railroads.
Yeah.
They improve the subsoil he has never disturbed, and many times their length, if support of their principles requires it. They battle with the tempests of a century. See what scars they bear, what limbs they've lost before we were born, yet they never adjourn. They steadily vote for their principles and send their roots further and wider from the same center. They die at their posts and they leave a tough butt for the choppers to exercise themselves about and a stump which serves for their monument.
That's just such an extraordinary passage. And he wrote like an angel. But it's such a powerful metaphor for this, the values and the principles of the abolitionists and the abolitionist movement.
There's another sort of, he extends the metaphor in this beautiful way and talks about how the center of the elm may decay, but the growth is really in the rings of the tree and the right. cambium under the bark. Cambium, right. And that is new.
Right. Yeah, and I think he's referring to the renewal of the movement and the passage or the passing on of these principles and values to a younger generation.
So what you write sort of along those lines, we talk about trees being witness trees to the past and how they were in the same place that many historic events happened and important people were. And they sort of draw our memory back.
Right.
But you wrote just that the trees over time put on new rings of growth and it's not really the same tree it was in the past and that each sort of generation after that gets to experience the tree in its own way and add their own history to it.
So in many New England towns and cities, so-called, and in the rural landscape too, these solitary elms, and they were mostly elms, but not always, right? There are witness oaks, there are other trees, but it's almost, it's more common that these witness trees were American elms, and they tend to be elms of substantial size and beauty and form. And one of the things I discovered was that they tended to draw to them historical events that occurred in the general area, but not necessarily right there. And over time, they come to be representative of the event and in that location. But in most cases, that wasn't
not necessarily right under that tree.
No, not necessarily right under there. So there's this remarkable, and this taps into what I was talking about, what we were talking about earlier about the, you know, nature's nation versus the stones of the old world, right? The ruins, the architectural ruins. So what is a more appropriate monument for this young nation? Is it the marble, obelisk, or is it a great old tree and reputed remnant of the original forest? And very few of these trees were remnants of the aboriginal forest, as was often said. There was a witness tree on the Boston Common, for example, where all sorts of associations were sort of tied to. And it was the Great Elm. And that was what it was called, the Great Elm of Boston Common. And in the book, you probably saw this. There's this remarkable photograph of all the Methodist ministers of New England gathered for a meeting. And they, where do they gather? Not in front of a Methodist church, right? But under this great witness tree. Another example is the Washington Elm, which I mentioned earlier in Cambridge, which was said to be where Washington, you know, he stood under this great elm when he took command of the Continental troops at the outset of the Revolution. Well, when the tree finally came down, which, by the way, was blamed on communists, that they had somehow sabotaged the tree, the rings were counted. And alas, you know, if Washington took command of the troops under this tree, he would have been crouching
a small
down
tree.
Below a little sapling. Yeah. So, yeah.
There's something about this being a living thing that was alive, yes, at that time. It's alive now, and it's somewhat different than a building. The buildings,
exactly,
were there, but we don't venerate the buildings in the same way.
We do now. I think we do now, but yeah, there was the fact that this was a living being, right? That this was a living entity that witnessed this passage, and it literally puts you into this continuum, right? Instead of an inertness that a building or a stone or monument would do.
It's a powerful thought. This seems to be just a very human reaction to old trees across cultures, over time.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering...
Well, it is. I mean, there are many cultures where you have a tree, often of a particular species, that plays a role, a sacred role, or, you know, a quasi-sacred role, the bow tree, the ceiba tree in Central Latin America, the bow tree in parts of Asia. And the American elm, I would say, is the closest thing we've had in the country to a sacred tree, and often very much in a religious dimension, as I said earlier, when you have this notion of the unhewn cathedrals, right? And the best example of that, which was world famous, was Temple Street, literally Temple Street in New Haven, which is the street that cuts right across the New Haven Green. And it was lined with elms, very closely, too closely, it turns out, planted. And it created this extraordinary, you know, and Dickens, when he visited, I think in the 1840s, he made this very celebrated trip to America, and he writes about it, right? He visits the Temple Street. It's on his list. It's on his bucket list there with Niagara Falls and New York City to see this remarkable example of American space.
I think one thing that drew me to this story in 1856 of this tree coming down is that, you know, we do this now. We venerate old trees and love them and recognize them. But here was Thoreau doing the same thing in a way 150, 160 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we seem to do this almost in every era, like we're looking back to another time.
Yeah. Yeah. But he, you know, really is at the forefront of this, because he's coming out of an era when we Americans did not really look to the natural world through a lens like that. It was, like I said earlier, it was much more exploitative.
Yeah. And it's not just a simple act of nostalgia to write about this tree either. He's looking to the future. He's looking at his current time.
Sure.
And the future. So just to wrap up, I have a question for you. Before you studied landscape architecture and urban planning and became a professor, you studied forestry.
Yeah, I did. Right.
ESF, and that's the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse.
In Syracuse, right.
And so you've had a long love of trees yourself and an interest in their ecology. What meaning does the Davis elm, as some people call it, or the American elm in general, if you prefer, have for you?
I can point to the exact moment and place where I fell in love with the American elm. It was I grew up in Brooklyn, and my mom used to bring us, my brother and I, to the American Museum of Natural History quite often, because it was right on, you know, from Brooklyn, from our part of Brooklyn. It was the D train. Now it's the B train, and it would, you know, there was a stop right there at the museum, and we would go. And in the Hall of North American Forests, or Hall of North American Trees, there were two exhibits that just moved me enormously. One was an enormous section of a redwood. It may have been a sequoia,
like a slab.
It was American. It was a California redwood. And it had, you know, the rings were very visible, and it had little markers showing, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire and this, that, you know, the fact that this was a record of, you know, basically, you know, this enormous passage in human history, that just, you know, and when I finally went out west myself, I worked for many summers as a firefighter with the United States Forest Service. I remember that was one of the things I first went to see were the redwoods. But across in this one exhibit hall, across from the redwood section, was a very evocative backlit painting. And it was titled simply the Elm in New England. And it was this very evocative, you know, romantic scene of these arching elm trees looking down a road into like this pastoral New England landscape. And I think there was a farmer there and little farm settlement. And it just, there was something about that image that just so moved me. And I also remember this is the early 70s. And when we would go with my family, when we would go up to the Adirondacks for, you know, an extended weekend, or, you know, the once a year family road trip, my dad would point out the skeletal remains of these dead elm trees, because this was the period when a lot of these great elms were still present in the landscape. They were dead. And there were actually a fair number that were still living. I remember at the Saratoga Springs, at the actual historic site, the springs, there were a couple of enormous, beautiful elms that, you know, that I actually still have the photos, the slides. And so I was very moved from an early age by this tree. And like you said, I fell in love with trees generally. I just really loved trees. And partly it was from, you know, summer camp and Bear Mountain. I remember I used to identify all the trees on the trails around Hessian Lake. So I did. I studied forestry. And then, as I said, I worked summers with the Forest Service. And in the process of studying forestry, I discovered landscape architecture, which had that creative dimension to it that I really found fascinating.
Well, I really enjoyed our conversation today. You mentioned that, I mean, you work on a lot of things, but you mentioned some work on trees that you're doing now.
Yeah. I'm actually working on a book that is really, you know, tracing the roots, quote unquote, of three New York trees, right? And they're not germane to exclusively New York City, but they're prominent entities in New York's urban landscape. And one is the American elm. We've talked about two of the three, the American elm. One is the Atlantis, tree of heaven. And the third is the London Plane, which the book is organized obviously in three parts. It begins with the elm, and that's called the Patrician. And then there's the whole part of the book. The second part is about the London plane, which is called the Cosmopolitan. And that's a reference to the London plane. I'm sure you know this is a hybrid. It was an accidental hybrid between the American Sycamore and the Asian or Oriental.
An Asian plane. Sycamore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This combined to create really one of the best street trees we've ever had. It's not quite as romantically beautiful as the American elm, but it's very tenacious and fast growing. And then the third part of the book is about the ailanthus, and that's called the immigrant. So it's the patrician, the cosmopolitan, and the immigrant. It's fun. I'm having a blast with it because I'm writing about obviously the cultural histories of these trees and how they came to gain a presence in our landscape.
Can't wait for that to come out and to read it. Maybe I'll have you back.
Yeah, that'd be great.
When that happens. But thanks again. Really enjoyed our conversation.
I've enjoyed it too. Take care.
Well, I'm going to end it there. Thank you, tree lovers, for joining us on this journey through the early history of the American elm. And thanks very much to Thomas Campanella for sharing his great work. Don't forget to subscribe if you enjoyed the show, and you can find photos of the trees featured here and other updates for this old tree on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Hopefully, together we can slow the indiscriminate removal of large, healthy trees. But the next time you see it happen, speak up. Thoreau would have your back. Here's arborist and songwriter Dee Lee to take us out.
This old tree, standing here for more than 4 centuries. Wonder what you'd say if you could talk to me about what it's like to be this old tree. Shadow and shade, kids down the block are selling lemonade. Send them down a cool breeze, a sweet cascade, tailor-made by this old tree. In 1600, you were just a seed, reaching for the sky high, waiting for a chance to take your place in the warm sunshine. Here I go, high above the place where the people grow. Leave my troubles on the ground far below, so I can get to know this old tree. Summer sparkle in your leaves. Autumn winds will bring a relief. Winter calls for you to sleep. Spring returns again in green. Above the town, ships on the water spy your royal crown. Sentinel of green, 2 points off starboard bow. Homeward bound to this old tree. In 1800, you felt the thunder roll, and lightning split the sky high. Though the fire raged in the little town below, you managed to survive. With the scar upon your side, this old tree, reach out and touch a living history. Beneath my hands, an ancient mystery. How small I am by this old tree. How small I am by this old tree.